thank you all for having me here today, and thanks to Carol and Hannah and the staff and the volunteers here for welcoming me and for your hospitality too. And I mentioned this the last time I spoke here. I have a real personal affinity for Locust Grove because my fifth great grandfather was actually the doctor who amputated George Rogers Clark's leg, Dr. Richard Ferguson. So Brian will not let me reenact that, unfortunately, here. But I've tried every time I've been here, but he won't let me do it. But it is wonderful to be here, and I know that Locust Grove has done a wide array of programs around dueling thanks to the musical Hamilton, which I'm sure all of you are very familiar with. And of course, the most famous duel in American history was that fight, that 1804 duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr. And again, you've likely seen programs here related to that. You've probably listened to the musical before. And while the Hamilton-Burr interest has really captured popular imagination in recent years, thanks to that musical, it is important to know that there were a number of important and also significant affairs of honor that were fought here in the Bluegrass State as well. Now, keep in mind that dueling was always illegal in Kentucky, and there were repercussions that befell duelists if they were involved with affairs of honor, and I'll touch on that a little bit later. But because of that, since duels were illegal, these formal structured fights were essentially usually kept out of public view. So therefore, we don't really have a firm handle on how many duels were fought in Kentucky, but we do know that dozens took place in the Commonwealth between about 1790 until roughly 1870 or so. So that's about sort of the scope of what I'll be discussing today. So most duels that were fought in Kentucky and across the Deep South had their roots in what was called the Southern Code of Honor. And to simplify it, really, the Code of Honor were unwritten rules of behavior that regulated how you acted and, more importantly, how your community viewed you. Above all, the white Southern males who adhered to this code wanted to avoid, above everything else, they wanted to avoid embarrassment and public shame. Those were the two things that they wanted to avoid at all costs. So, for example, if someone from your same social class insulted you or slighted you or somehow bruised your honor if they cheated you, you could challenge them to a duel in order to sort of cleanse that stain upon your honor and to essentially protect your reputation within the community. Otherwise, if you don't do that, your friends and your neighbors may end up shunning you and branding you as a coward. Historian John Mayfield has called honor a Homeric virtue where it was imperative to, quote, affirm one's worth publicly and to resist at any cost threats to that reputation. Moreover, as historian Ed Ayers has written, honor was a system of values within which you have as exactly much worth as others confer upon you. So there's both an internal and an external sort of segments to the honor culture. So when honor was maligned, whether it was from insults or social slights or failed business deals or if you'd been cheated, arguments, many other issues, that could cause this, blue-blooded Kentuckians could solve the affront by fighting a formal, structured duel. And as we know, many prominent Kentuckians, including Henry Clay, Robert Wycliffe, Cash Clay, John Rowan, and others, all fought duels in order to maintain their reputations. So among these men, their personal reputation essentially outweighed any legal consequences that they might face that would help curtail dueling. Kentucky laws against the practice had been initially proposed as early as 1799, and anyone who was convicted of either fighting a duel or acting as a second to help that duel or even issuing a challenge could face legal consequences and you'd be banned from public office for 7 years. They wanted to sort of present the upper crust who had political aspirations from dueling by instilling that ban in public office. Furthermore, all public officials, including lawyers, state legislators, judges, the governor, all had to swear an oath that they had not challenged, dueled, or helped duelists in any way. And as many of you know, this oath became part of the 1850 Constitution in the state. And even to this day, attorneys, the governor, legislators have to swear that, you know, raise their hand and say, I've never participated in a duel, which always gets a great chuckle from the crowd. Even I work at the Kentucky Historical Society now, and even our members of our executive board have to swear that oath as well. So it's always sort of fun. We do that at our annual meeting every year. Also, if attorneys dueled, for example, they could lose their law licenses. They would only get those back if they were pardoned by the governor, for example. So these are ways they tried to prevent sort of upper crust professionals from engaging in public affairs of honor. And if you were sort of caught dueling, you could be fined or even sentenced to prison. Of course, if you killed a man in a duel, you could be charged with murder. But as we know, these laws did little to dissuade many upper class Kentuckians from dueling. And when men like Henry Clay, again, these prominent Kentuckians, the men who were placed on this high societal platform, when they fought duels, it essentially placed a cultural stamp upon dueling and encouraged other people to participate in those affairs of honors. In addition, courts rarely prosecuted duelists. So think of the practice as being a well-regulated, community-sanctioned form of violence that was socially acceptable among the upper classes as a means of conflict resolution. And as crazy as that sounds, that's how it was among many people in Kentucky during that period. So because judges, lawyers, politicians, prominent Kentuckians participated in these fights, the lax attitude that Kentuckians felt toward dueling was actually known regionally and even nationally. There was one out-of-state duelist who was fighting somewhere in the Deep South, and he later said about his future opponent, quote, "I wish I had him in Kentucky that I might kill the dog without the trouble of fighting him." So again, this was the attitude that people had. If you could come into Kentucky, you could shoot and kill someone without having to worry about any sort of legal consequences. Yay, Kentucky, right? Hooray! So that attitude also held true regionally because a lot of out-of-state duelists would come to the Bluegrass State to fight as a way to avoid prosecution. So Andrew Jackson, before he was president, came to Kentucky, fought a duel. Sam Houston, before he was governor of Texas when he lived in Tennessee, he ended up also coming into the Bluegrass State and sort of fought near the Dueling Grounds Racetrack, which is appropriately named. That's one reason it got its name, down in southern Kentucky near the Tennessee border, because they wanted to make it difficult to sort of determine prosecutorial jurisdiction when prosecutors wanted to charge people with fighting in these duels. So again, some of these gentlemen who dueled, included some of Kentuckians' most prominent citizens. And in 1807, state legislators Henry Clay and Humphrey Marshall both argued in the Kentucky House of Representatives. So, you know, these two great, well-known gentlemen are having an argument. And again, this is shortly before the War of 1812. Tensions were high with Great Britain. And Henry Clay proposed that Kentuckians should only purchase, quote, clothes of domestic manufacture. So as a way to support local commerce, local business, local manufacturing, Clay said, look, we just need to wear homespun clothing. So Humphrey Marshall, who is a former U.S. congressman, called Clay's idea, quote, the claptrap of a demagogue. Insulted, Henry Clay challenged Marshall to a duel, and then Marshall, of course, accepted. And the duel was fought near Louisville with pistols at probably 10 paces. And that was the typical typical weapons and distance fought for a duel were pistols at 10 paces, which is roughly 30 feet or so. Both men missed twice. They shot each other two times, both missed, decided they still wanted to keep this affair of honor going. Honor had not been satisfied. So on the third fire, Marshall shot Clay in the leg, giving him a minor wound. So imagine what would have happened to American politics if Clay had been killed that in 1807, that early on. But of course, this was not Clay's only duel. In 1826, when he was a United States Senator, his colleague John Randolph of Virginia called him, quote, a cross between the Puritan and the blackleg. I have no idea what that means, but Clay was, of course, insulted, challenged Randolph to a duel, and the two politicians fought with pistols outside of Washington, D.C., and the men missed the first volley. On the second shot, they reloaded their pistols. Clay fired quickly and missed, and John Randolph simply raised his dueling pistol in the air and fired, and that gesture of kindness, meant a lot to Clay, and the two men ended up reconciling. And so, again, Henry Clay, despite the fact he fought several duels during his lifetime, including when he was a U.S. Senator, became known as the Great Compromiser. Of course, dueling does not seem to be a very good way to compromise, but he earned the nickname nonetheless. But so dueling and the worship of Southern honor culture seemingly ran in the Clay family, even. Henry Clay's cousin, Cassius Marcellus Clay, was sort of a firebrand emancipationist from around Richmond, Kentucky. And as many of you know, that he frequently found himself in political squabbles over his anti-slavery views, and he ended up fighting several duels and also a number of Bowie knife fights as a result of getting in arguments with people. In one instance, he actually hacked the nose and plucked the eye out of an opponent's face after he got attacked after giving a speech. So a very tough character. And as those of you familiar with this site know, in May 1841, Cassius Clay and Robert Wickliffe Jr. fought a duel here at Locust Grove, correct? So just on the grounds here, very close to where we are. And again, they fought with pistols at 10 paces. And of course, you know, these men seemed to be steely-nerved gentlemen facing one another with pistols at 10 paces. But of course, it was very nerve-wracking for these men to fight. And Cassius Clay and Wickliffe exchanged several shots at one another, and then they decided to halt the fight, saying that honor had been satisfied. Now, Clay was known as being a wonderful pistol shot. It was said that he could sever a silver chain 5 out of 7 times by shooting at it from 10 paces. So you're a good shot if you can do that. But after the fight, when they kept missing one another, one of Clay's friends said, "What's the deal? I thought you could shoot a silver chain at 10 paces. Why did you keep missing?" And Clay responded, "Well, the damn chain never had a pistol in his hand pointing at me." So, you know, fairly nerve-wracking for people to fight these duels. There's another instance where there was a duel. They fired 3 shots at one another, and one of the seconds said, "Well, let the men shake hands and reconcile." And the other second, who's sort of a wag, said, "Well, their hands have been shaking this half hour already." You know, so nerves were certainly well known on the dueling ground. Well, again, gentlemen, attorneys, judges seem to be the people who frequently fought duels. But even those who whose lives were dedicated to saving life and preserving life, they even found themselves on the field of honor on occasion. They were not immune to dueling. And in 1818, 2 Lexington doctors actually tangled in an affair of honor. So although the Hippocratic Oath, what, says, first, do no harm. Well, who needs the oath? Southern honor's on the line. So these two doctors had gotten an argument over what? They'd gotten in an argument over a post-mortem examination, and after a number of machinations, ended up finding themselves on the dueling ground. So yes, they fought a duel over an autopsy, essentially, a very strange reason. But it was William Richardson and Dr. Benjamin Dudley. They fought on a farm outside of Lexington, again with pistols at 10 paces, the typical weapon. And Dudley actually shot Richardson in the upper leg. And as the doctor lay on the ground, he's actually bleeding to death from this wound. His opponent, again, who was also a doctor, actually stepped in and saved his opponent's life. So if you go away from this talk with anything, I want you to know this. If you're going to duel, duel a doctor, because they will save your life, hopefully afterwards. But again, you know, it just shows how seriously these men took their professional reputations and how sort of honor was on the line as a result of that as well. Kentucky newspaper editors were also frequently involved in dueling. As you can imagine, they're constantly writing editorials that might insult someone, so they frequently found themselves at odds with readers or with each other. And a lot of times these arguments sort of spilled off the page and spilled onto the dueling ground. In one instance, there were 2 prominent Louisville editors who nearly dueled, and instead their confrontation played itself out in a gunfight in downtown Louisville. And this is an instance where, again, the 2 men didn't find themselves fighting a formal structure duel, but it was an affair of honor in its own right. And it shows how some Kentucky residents avoided duels yet still remained within that structure of the Southern Honor Code that I talked about. And so most of you have probably heard of George Prentice, right? George Prentice, he had the statue in front of the Louisville Free Public Library for a long time. And then Reuben Durrett. And Prentice was the editor of the Louisville Journal. Durrett, who was editor of the Louisville Courier, was sort of the rival newspaper of Prentice's Journal. We now know it as the Courier Journal that merged later. But Durrett was actually also one of the founders of what is now the Filson Historical Society as well. So he was very interested in research and book collecting and manuscript collecting. So as a vocal and sometimes controversial editor, George Prentice, as we all know, was not afraid to make enemies. And although political differences frequently put him at odds with others, the root of the animosity between Prentice and Durrett was based on articles that had been written and a rivalry between their 2 newspapers. So their competitiveness came to a head in the summer of 1857 when Prentice wrote an editorial accusing a local politician of basically being a drunkard, of being a terrible alcoholic, so much to the point that it really hindered his political career. And in response, Durrett and the Louisville Courier published an anonymous article charging Prentice with alcoholism and more. The article called Prentiss an abolitionist, which of course was a scurrilous insult to give to 19th century antebellum Kentuckians. And it also said that Prentiss had fallen into the Ohio River while drunk, and he was, quote, an imported wooden nutmeg Yankee. Now, if you're going to shoot someone, that may be a strange thing to get upset about, but again, Prentiss was called an imported wooden nutmeg Yankee. So, enraged about this, Prentiss sent Durrett a number of notes demanding to know if Durrett had indeed written the article. Prentiss said that if Durrett did not admit to being the author, he was indeed a coward, and this led to a flurry of exchanges. Filing this in the seventh note, and all these notes were exchanged basically on one day, Prentiss told Durrett, quote, I shall denounce you to your face the first time I see you upon the street. I shall be upon Third Cross Street myself in half an hour or less, and I hope I shall not have to look for you long. So Prentiss, of course, meant business. And now, while many upper-class Kentuckians would have sent a formal challenge to duel at this point, of course, George Prentiss went by the beat of his own drummer, and he did not seek a formal fight. Instead, as a master of wordplay and nuance, Prentiss either supported or confirmed or agreed to the practice of dueling, either supported or condemned it whenever it suited him, essentially. And so he was always willing to meet an opponent without the formality of a structured duel, though. 2 years earlier, Henry Clay's son, James B. Clay, had sent Prentiss a challenge to duel because of several newspapers that Prentiss had written that had been disparaging James's father, Henry Clay. Prentiss said that he found the idea of dueling to be repugnant when he turned James Clay down. He said, we scorn and abhor the whole infamous code of duelists. If at our present age we were to allow ourselves to fight a duel with Mr. J.B. Clay on account of our comments on his abusive article recently published by us, we should feel as though we had forfeited all claims to mankind's respect and our own. Yet we do not call ourselves non-combatants. If any man feels himself mortally aggrieved at any publication of ours, he knows, whether we accept a challenge from him or not, where to find us, and he may seek us when and how he pleases. So again, he was not afraid to back down from a fight and was sort of calling Clay out, saying, look, if you're really upset about this, come find me in my office and we'll settle it. Durrett, Reuben Durrett, again the editor of the Courier, also discovered that Prentiss sought out those who aggrieved him. And on the afternoon that he and Prentiss had exchanged notes, Durrett walked toward the law office of G.D. Hinkle, which is down on Jefferson Street in downtown Louisville. And Prentiss was loaded down with deadly weapons, it was said. He approached Durrett, and the two men exchanged a number of harsh words that are unrepeatable here in this lovely crowd. But they exchanged words, and then they drew pistols and started shooting at one another. So Prentiss, with a pistol in each hand, fired from the street. Durrett pulled a gun, stepped inside of Hinkle's law office, and started shooting at Prentiss from around the door. So it seems to me to be the more sensible thing to do. But while witnesses were unclear about who fired first, it was later counted that Prentiss fired four times, Durrett fired three shots. Now, as gunfire echoed down Jefferson Street, Hinkle, the attorney whose law office this was, what does he do? Does he cower behind a desk? No! He runs forward to try to break up the fight. What does he get in thanks? Well, a random shot from one of Prentiss's bullets struck him in the ankle, and he fell to the ground screaming. So, Prentiss ended up shooting the wrong person. Durrett hightailed it out the back door, and Prentiss, though, did get shot in the leg and remained lying on Jefferson Street. So he had two men injured in this public shooting scrape. Prentiss was hit. It was called a slight wound in the fleshy part of the leg below the knee. So this fight, as you can imagine, gunshots ringing down the streets of Louisville, quickly drew a crowd. One gentleman who came out said, quote, at the clubhouse between 4th and 5th Streets, I heard pistol shots, and coming out, I found a crowd collected. Mr. Prentiss on the pavement and Mr. Durrett not to be seen. Well, the shootout opened up another war of words, and Prentiss claimed he did not waylay Mr. Durrett. Instead, I stood openly upon the sidewalk, and he claimed that Durrett fired first. He also said, or he later published all the notes that were, and published them in the Louisville Journal, and in response to all of that, and sort of making their squabble very public, Durrett then wrote Prentiss telling him, quote, it's evident from these notes that you desire to take my life. I'm perfectly willing to afford you an opportunity to do it at such time and place as will ensure a fair meeting between us and without the interference on the part of others. So again, Durrett wanted to fight a formal duel outside of Louisville. He was not content to sort of engage in this street fight, thought it was below him. And Durrett said, the fact that you shot an innocent person during our encounter, evidently by mistake, should admonish you that the street is not a proper place for the settlement of our difficulty. Instead, we don't like each other. Let's go out in the field and shoot one another. Yeah. Why not? That makes perfect sense, right? So he said, let's go outside of town and let's fight. So Prentice instead, however, decided that the rivalry was over. Again, he sort of did what he wanted to when it came to Southern honor. And he wrote Durrett that Durrett was a coward for running inside of Hinkle's law office and for refusing to fight out in the open on the street. And because of this, in Prentice's mind, Durrett was no longer a man of honor, and he was only worthy of Prentice's disdain. And he wrote, "I now care nothing for your life or death. You stand or lie disgraced before the community, and I shall do nothing to relieve you from your position." Again, Durrett had shame had befallen him for hiding behind the door. And again, what do Southern gentlemen want to avoid at all costs? Is that public disgrace, public shame? The way you erase that shame and charges of being a coward was fighting a formal duel and sort of standing across from your opponent and fighting. But instead, Durrett would not give him that opportunity to relieve himself of that shame. So he would fight him, which is sort of a really cold, cruel thing for him to do in the first place. He essentially said, "You are no longer equal to me. You are not a gentleman." And then he then cut off communication. So newspapers around the country thought this was crazy, as we can imagine. One Ohio newspaper said that Prentice was a better marksman with the pen than the pistol. He should have the good sense to stick to his favorite weapon. So a lot of newspapers were just befuddled over the fact that these two Louisville gentlemen were fighting on the street in this way and then sending challenge notes. Well, as news of the fight spread, authorities intervened. They actually arrested Prentice and Durrett, required them to each post a $3,000 bond to keep the peace. Despite this, Prentice again sent another formal challenge to duel. Prentice said, "No, I'm morally opposed to dueling." And so he went from saying, "You're a coward, you're not my equal, I'm not going to duel you," to saying that he was, again, morally opposed to dueling, even though he was fine to pull out a concealed weapon and shoot at someone. But such is how Kentucky was during the 19th century. Well, Durrett and Prentice, though, were not the only newspaper editors to fight. But unlike these two, some chose the formal dueling ground. Charles Wycliffe was the son of a prominent Lexington family, and his siblings were all friends with Mary Todd Lincoln. And in 1829, Wycliffe became angry over an article that was published in the Kentucky Gazette newspaper that had disparaged his father. So what does he do? He goes down to the Kentucky Gazette newspaper and ends up killing the editor of that. Was not charged. It was sort of seen as an act of honor. So he was really let off the hook for essentially what was murder. Well, the new editor, George Trotter, became the new editor of the Gazette. Well, then started publishing articles about how terrible it was that Wycliffe killed this first editor. So what happens? Wycliffe then challenges him to a duel for writing those articles. So they ended up going to a farm outside of Lexington, decided to settle their differences formally. They fought with pistols at 8 feet. Not 30 feet, which was typical. This shows you how serious these men were about one killing the other. They chose pistols at 8 feet. George Trotter ended up shooting and killing Wycliffe in that encounter. A few years later, Trotter had another violent encounter with guess who? George Prentice. So again, these newspaper editors were constantly having arguments that would then, again, spill off the newspaper page into the street. Two Frankfurt editors dueled in 1856 is another example. And then in 1857, an editor, Andrew Jackson Morey, who's with the Kentucky News, and F.L. McChesney of the Kentucky Age, had a personal encounter using cudgels. So they encountered each other on the street with clubs and beat the living heck out of each other. So it's better than shooting one another, I suppose, but still, being an editor in 19th century Kentucky was certainly a dangerous proposition. So. In many of these duels, as I noted, Kentuckians tended to issue challenges because of insults. And in 1848, Roger Hanson, who was a Lexington attorney, became enraged when his cousin ended up becoming engaged to a planter named William K. Duke. Now, Hanson secretly was in love with his cousin, wanted to marry her himself, but she instead became engaged to Duke. He was jealous of the engagement, so Hanson started bad-mouthing Duke to his cousin, which, of course, got back to Duke. So when Duke heard about these insults, he challenged Hanson to a duel. And in order to avoid prosecution, again, duelists tended to go across state lines. They crossed the Ohio River, went to VV, Indiana. Some of you may know that little beautiful little community. And there they decided to fight a formal duel. Now, Hanson used one of Andrew Jackson's dueling pistols, while true to form, Duke used one of Henry Clay's. You have this, you know, political rivals end up having their pistols used in this 1857 duel. Well, The duelists missed each other three times. On their fourth fire, however, Duke shot Hansen in the leg. Again, the fourth fire, so they missed each other three times, then fired again. Because of the leg wound, Hansen limped for the rest of his life. He was later given the nickname Old Bench Leg because of that wound, or because of that, his limp. Terrible nickname. You know, he wants to be called Old Bench Leg. But Hansen later served in the state legislature. Again, it shows how Kentuckians supported the practice of dueling by electing men who'd fought formal negotiated duels. He later became a noted Confederate general and was killed during the Battle of Stones River at Murfreesboro, Tennessee, while leading the Orphan Brigade, which is one of Kentucky's most famous pro-Confederate units. 10 days after that duel, however, Duke married Hanson's cousin. So despite the duel, Duke ended up marrying Hanson's cousin. I doubt that poor old Benchleg attended the wedding, however. His invitation was probably lost in the mail, one would assume. These are, though, sort of well-established professionals that I've talked about. But younger sort of students who tried to wear the mantle of gentlemanly behavior and claim that they were honorable men also fought duels. And when Nicholas Perkins attended Center College in Danville before the Civil War, he dueled with another student and was shot in the hand, and his hand remained mangled for the rest of his life, sort of a grim reminder of his duel fought during his student days before the Civil War. Not to be outdone by Center students, on October 5th, 1852, two students from Transylvania University fought a duel outside of Lexington using shotguns loaded with slugs at 40 yards. Again, meaning business here. And in that episode, one of the transy students shot and killed the other one at the first fire by shooting him through the head. So pretty terrible, terrible stuff. Was not prosecuted, though, because, again, judges, prosecutors tended to turn a blind eye toward that. It was the personal responsibility. If you found yourself on the dueling ground, it was your risk or you took that risk for fighting. Among the prominent Kentucky natives, though, who were embroiled in affairs of honor, perhaps none is as well known as Abraham Lincoln. So our 16th president was called, Henry Clay called him my beau ideal, or Lincoln called Clay my beau ideal of a statesman, and he almost followed Clay's sort of pattern of ending up on the dueling ground. In 1842, the Illinois state auditor challenged Lincoln over the authorship of several letters that insulted him that had been written to a local newspaper. Again, anonymous letters were frequently the cause of these duels. So during duels, the challenged party got to choose the weapon and the time and place. So if you challenged me to a duel, I'd say, all right, we're going to fight here at Locust Grove using pistols at 10 paces. Then they'd negotiate that. Well, Lincoln, however, decided to choose broadswords because he knew that the man who had challenged him was much, much shorter. And since Lincoln had sort of honed his physical strength while, you know, chopping wood on the Kentucky and Illinois frontier, you know, he was much more massive than this man, so he chose broadswords. And that state auditor refused to fight. So he said, no, I'm going to do pistols. Lincoln said, no, 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 we are doing broadswords. And then negotiations eventually sputtered out, and the duel never took place. But it allows one to wonder what would have happened would Lincoln have become president if he had hacked a man to death with a broadsword in the late 1840s. We know he got 7 votes in Fayette County, Kentucky in the 1860 election, but if he had dueled, I would guarantee he would have gotten more votes at that time. If he had dueled, you know, the honor-bound South probably would have given him a few more votes. Well, duels were typically caused, again, by insults, political controversies. Some were sometimes caused by stranger reasons. In 1819, two Kentuckians in Frankfort fought a duel because one of the men had killed the other man's dog. And one of the men ended up dying as a result of that formal duel. In another incident in 1801, John Rowan, you may know the name because he lived in the house in Bardstown, that's my old Kentucky home fame. John Rowan was drinking with another man at a Bardstown tavern. Rowan had fought several duels in his lifetime, but they were playing cards, drinking, got in an argument over which man had better mastery over ancient languages. They fought a duel over who could speak Latin and Greek better, essentially. But that led to a fist fight, so it's probably more the fist fight that led to the duel. But again, these strange reasons. But Rowan ended up killing that man in that duel. And at the Kentucky Historical Society, one of my favorite artifacts we have is actually a ring that Rowan had fashioned, or someone had fashioned and gave to him, that contains the hair of the man he killed in that duel. And we have a dueling exhibit open out at the old state capitol. That ring's on display, or you can go online and find it. Just look up John Rowan on our catalog, but you can see the hair sort of coiled around. And one wonders, it was said that Rowan really regretted killing Dr. James Chambers was his name, killing Chambers in the duel. And so you wonder if he had that crafted as a memento to remind him to never fight another duel again, never to let passion get the best of him. So again, we have some strange artifacts related to that fight. So by the time of the Civil War, however, duels started to fall out of fashion in Kentucky, and especially during the war. As the conflict progressed and as Americans were killing one another in droves on the battlefield, the idea of fighting a formal, structured, negotiated duel just began to seem absurd to most Americans. But there were some duels fought during the war. As Carol mentioned in my intro, I'm working on a book now about a duel that was fought in 1862 between a Union colonel and a local secessionist from Maysville. They ended up fighting that duel with rifles at 60 yards, and only one man walked away. So dueling was still sort of in the air during the Civil War, but typically because, again, men were fighting on the battleground, they tended to avoid affairs of honor. However, despite the carnage of the Civil War, there were also a few duels after that conflict in the Bluegrass State. In 1866, for example, a former Union sergeant fought a duel against a former Confederate officer. Both men had been terribly wounded in the war years before. They returned from the war physically broken, yet despite that, Southern honor culture sort of pushed them onto the dueling ground. And even though they seemed unimaginable carnage and horror on battlefields across the nation, in 1866, they still stood across from each other and fought a formal duel. Now, the two participants, Joseph Deshaies and Alexander Kimbrough, were branded as two young bloods of Cynthiana. One had been, again, a Union sergeant. Both were from Harrison County. They'd gotten in, they hated each other when they were children. And this is what ended up pushing them to the dueling ground, ultimately. Despite the fact one had been a former Union officer, the other a former Confederate, that had nothing to do with the duel. They ran into each other unexpectedly in a Cynthiana hotel. And there, Deshaies, the former Confederate, extended his hand. And Harrison said, "How dare you approach me, you scoundrel?" Deshaies picked up a chair, hit him across the head with it, and they had a brawl. When the fight ended, the two men were pulled apart, but later challenge notes ensued, and they ended up fighting a duel on a farm outside of Lexington using Henry Clay's dueling pistols, fighting at 10 paces. And I think Ashland, the Henry Clay estate, probably still owns those dueling pistols. Again, both men had been terribly wounded during the war. Deshaies had actually been struck in the head by a cannonball at the Battle of Murfreesboro, Tennessee. He'd been wounded in the arm at the Battle of Chickamauga, and he was wounded again at the Battle of Dalton, Georgia, where his left arm was badly shattered. Despite this, he fought a duel. His opponent, Alexander Kimbrough, was in the same boat. He'd been hit in the left leg, terribly wounded at the Battle of Chickamauga in September 1863. His leg was shattered, and he was essentially disabled from service. Yet again, these two men found one another on the dueling ground. So on the first fire, the two men missed, but on the second fire, Deshaies ended up hitting Kimbrough in one of the hips. The bullet went through his body and then exited out of the other hip. So he immediately fell, and again, this man who had already had a shattered left leg spent the rest of his life with a terrible limp, complaining of terrible pain. And one pension application he wrote, he said, "I can no longer walk over plowed ground." So it gives you an idea of how much he was hobbling around. He ended up moving around, lived in various Union veterans' homes, ended up dying in 1921, was buried in Cynthiana. Deshaies, after wounding Kimbrough, again, dueling was illegal, he ended up fleeing to Canada, lived in exile in Canada for more than 10 years until Kentucky Governor James B. McCreary, who was also a former Confederate officer, ended up pardoning him. Deshaies came back to Cynthiana, where he spent a career breeding and raising thoroughbred horses. So he finally came back 10 years later. When he died, he was also buried in the Cynthiana Cemetery. So you have these two duelists who now are sort of united under the same ground and in an odd sort of way. Well, this duel fought in March 1866 was one of the last formal duels fought in Kentucky. And it also serves as a memorable pivot point for when, as a way to think of the way how upper-class white Kentucky males changed the way that they applied violence in their lives. No longer would Kentuckians send challenge notes if they were insulted. From then on out, after the Civil War, they would carry concealed weapons, either pistols or knives. Instead of fighting a formal negotiated duel, they would instead fight with brutality on the streets of their communities. And the mass availability of firearms after the Civil War, public and judicial indifference toward concealed weapons, and a lack of prosecution thanks to essentially dubious claims of self-defense is what really drove this change in how these Kentuckians were essentially settling conflicts. They still use violence, which is done very informally. A good example of this post-war change involved an attorney and newspaper editor, of course, named Thomas Marshall Green. He was a Danville native. He was an 1855 graduate of Center College, and he had actually lost his law license before the Civil War for dueling. Of course he did. So when that fight ended his legal career, he ended up becoming a newspaper editor, which, you know, if you want to keep fighting, become an editor in 19th century Kentucky, but that didn't end his violent confrontation. So in the early 1880s, he wrote a number of newspaper articles accusing a Nicholasville politician of voter fraud. And this, of course, enraged this politician who I think had sort of stolen some poll books, allegedly stolen some poll books. And this just infuriated him, and he actually showed up at Green's office one day and threatened him, but Green was not there. So they knew that a confrontation would happen. And on the day, a few months later, on the day that the statue of U.S. Vice President and Confederate Secretary of War John C. Breckinridge, his statue was dedicated in downtown Lexington. On that day, Green and this newspaper, or this Nicholasville politician, ran into one another on the street outside of the Phoenix Hotel in Lexington. So they had a sharp argument about the article. Again, they started hurling profanity at one another, and so in perfect form, just like Durrett and Prentice, they pulled pistols and began shooting at one another. Well, Green ended up killing his opponent, and then just like that other incident, one of the bystanders, innocent bystanders, was also wounded. Thanks to claims of self-defense, authorities never prosecuted Green, and he later earned some renown for writing two books, one called The Spanish Conspiracy, it's about Burr, and the second one called Historic Families of Kentucky, which is essentially a sweeping genealogical study of some prominent Kentucky families. Again, he was never prosecuted for killing this Nicholasville politician. Violence and the way it was applied changed in the years after the Civil War. And this is a good example of how violence evolved among upper-class Kentuckians after that conflict. So, again, the mass bloodshed of the war essentially ended the practice of fighting formal duels. If Green had disparaged this politician in 1850, for example, the politician simply would have sent Green a challenge to duel, and they would have settled it that way. But so much had changed in Kentucky by 1880. Instead, using concealed weapons, they handled their differences out on the street. The Civil War ended the practice of formal dueling, but it didn't stop white upper-class Kentuckians from taking insult easily and from using violence to settle differences. Blue-blooded touchiness was still very much of a thing in the years after the Civil War. So street fights like this one, when coupled with well-publicized feuds in eastern Kentucky, the assassination of Governor William Goebel in 1900, as you can imagine, it pushed Kentucky's reputation into the gutter. Newspapers across the nation would frequently run 24-hour accountings of violence in Kentucky. So it'd be a listing, you know, from Monday to Tuesday, this man was killed in an ambush in Rowan County, this man was killed on the street in Lexington, this man was murdered in Maysville, and they would run this. It would just be a long article because the national public was just dumbfounded over the violence that had sort of seized Kentucky during this period. And this lasted well into the early 1900s. So, of course, as news of these violent incidents spread, as Governor Goebel was assassinated in 1900, Kentucky was no longer seen as the erudite home of great compromisers like Henry Clay. Instead, our reputation went down into the gutter, and is one, as we all know, we sometimes still have to deal with. And those stereotypes of Kentuckians still exist. So instead of fighting duels, the way that men handled themselves on the street and the way they used violence as a way to settle conflicts changed, and it was certainly not for the better. But thank you all for having me here today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. And as Carol mentioned, just to do a very mercenary plug, in March, I've got a book on that murder on a steamboat that still involves Southern honor. So a lot of the themes that I talked about in that will be in that book that will come out in March. So any questions about? Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was curious. It sounds like in the early summation of dueling, were there just available districts with dueling pistols? Or like how, if there was a duel, they wanted Henry Clay's pistols, did they send for them? Was there like a protocol for getting these dueling pistols?
Right, that's a great question. Typically, most gentlemen sort of had their own set of finely crafted dueling pistols. And so when pistols like Clay's or Andrew Jackson's were used, it was typically they would have been friends of the family, more often than not, or the second would have been friends of the family. In some instances, it was actually difficult for people to procure weapons, and so they had to go to great lengths. So The one I'm writing the book about, they decided to use Colt revolving rifles at 60 yards. But they had a hard time finding these rifles. And the second finally said, look, you can just use two that I have. But then they had to get ammo, and that was difficult. And they didn't want to buy any because then the authorities would know that someone was out target, practicing. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of under the cover of night things that went on when men were trying to have these duels take place. But typically, if they were using sort of famous weapons, it was because somebody knew the opponent. But they liked, you know, that was the whole part of the formality of it and the ritual. Like, ritual was very important. You know, the sending of notes and having somebody negotiate on your behalf. And then, lo and behold, we're using Henry Clay's pistols. It's like, my fine, you know, wine. You know, it's like instead of, you know, bragging about your fine Corinthian leather, it's all about whose pistol you're using. So,
how did they choose who went first? Was it
the way the duels worked, it wasn't the back-to-back walk and turn. They would stand 10 paces apart. They would flip a coin to determine who gave the call to fire. So one of the seconds, who were the assistants who helped with the duel, they would end up giving the call to fire. And they would say, ready, fire, 1, 2, 3, stop. And you could shoot at any time during that three-second period is how it worked. And so you could either wait and see what happened, or you could just shoot pretty quickly. One Kentucky duelist actually killed his opponent using a hip shot. So he fired quickly and ended up hitting his opponent. So. But again, different weapons were chosen, sometimes shotguns, I mentioned, sometimes rifles, but it was typically pistols. One man was challenged to a duel in Lexington, and he said, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to go to the local doctor's office, and we're going to be bled. The doctor's going to open a vein, and whoever gives up first loses. And that's what they ended up doing. So you can imagine these two pasty, white-faced men going, all right, I'm done. Honor satisfied. And honestly, if you wanted to get out of a duel, sometimes if you picked, you know, the pistols at 8 paces is crazy. We all know it's crazy. Well, pistols at 30 feet is crazy too. But there's one duel where a man said, okay, we're going to do double barrel shotguns. We're going to do it at 3 feet. We're going to have a wire strung. The guns are going to be resting on a wire at our chests. And we'll pull both triggers when he says fire. And so it was so suicidal. The guy's like, I can't deal with you. And they didn't fight. So, yeah, on occasion you could get out. And it was seen as being dishonorable, though, if you sort of like dueling too much. There's a guy named Alexander Keith McClung, who's known as the Black Knight of the South, who fought a number of duels, and I think including one around Louisville. But he sort of gained this terrible reputation, because the idea was he wanted to avoid bloodshed and wanted to avoid passion, but he was seen as being sort of, again, the Black Knight. But he ended up committing suicide later, so you sort of wonder if it was this, you know, sort of his victims haunting him, but... If you ever need a good song idea, the Black Knight of the South, baby. So that'll be the way to do it. I'll send you an article on him. So, yes, sir.
Was there one state that more duels happened than the other
state? I'm not sure specifically with statistics because people sort of hit it, but I know that Mississippians were sort of always considered to be kind of very, very touchy and very hair-triggered. So the reputation of Mississippi was that was, you know, Mississippians tended to have that attitude. In Louisville, actually, there was one case where a judge from Mississippi was up here for a wedding, and he and some of his friends ended up stabbing and killing a Louisville tailor because they didn't like the form of the suit. And have you all heard of Kentucky attorney Ben Hardin at all? Ben Hardin was a noted Bardstown attorney. He was actually, I think, a prosecutor of that case, and he coined the phrase I love, which is the Bowie knife and pistol gentry. So he talked about the Bowie knife and pistol gentry from Mississippi coming up and fighting duels. You know, so he's sort of, you know, talking about that sort of blue blood Southern class of people who were very touchy. One person said that you know, they were so touchy that if a cat tread on your toe, they'd shoot the cat. Was sort of the, you know, the stereotype that they had. So Mississippi was hit with sort of that stereotype. So. Yes, sir.
Talking about, it wasn't exactly duels, but it was later on that you said that they use clubs, they use knives. And it brings to mind, I've read the history of the Hatfields and the McCoys. It all started with slights, and it wasn't just the two people. It was, if you slight, you slight my brother, I'm going to take care of you, and my sons are going to take care of this one, until the states almost declared war on them.
Right. And the way to think, sort of that honor culture sort of pervaded all levels of society. There's one historian, Lorian Foote, who wrote a great book, and Dr. Foote talks about how, you know, it wasn't only upper class people who sort of adhered to these structures of honor. It was just sort of different. So a lot of even the more working class folks, instead, they would just sort of have an immediate fist fight. So honor was still there. If you got insulted, you would still handle it immediately. Honor was also interesting because if someone from a lower class insulted you, you would not challenge them to a duel because they were not a gentleman. They were not worthy of dueling. Instead, you would either horsewhip or cowhide that person and essentially put them at the same level of an enslaved man. And so, you know, there are even these sort of different strictures within that code of honor of how you treat people. So the book I've got coming out, it's actually, there was a clerk on a boat ended up insulting a Mississippian by manhandling him out of a cabin. The Mississippian then killed the clerk, sort of claiming that it was, you know, his right to do it. But of course, if you kill someone, don't kill a crewman on a steamboat full of angry sailors, because it will not be good for you in the end. And he met a pretty terrible end as a result of doing that. So not everyone adhered to sort of the upper class, you know, code of honor and sort of handled things on their own. So, yes, sir.
I was just curious, is there any record of any female duels? Sex duels?
Right, the question was, I'll repeat the question. Were there any records of female duels? I've seen a couple of sort of passing accounts in newspapers before, but it's hard to tell if it's sort of, I don't know if it's more poking fun about the whole situation or not, but I've seen at least one or two accounts of that, but I don't know if it's true or not. I know in Kentucky I've never seen that. I mean, yes, sir.
Is this truly an American experience, the honor, or was it occurring in Europe and other cultures at the same time?
Right, the question was dueling an American experience or did it happen in other cultures at the same time? And actually, sort of the concept of dueling and honor was imported from Europe. So it tended to be Europeans who brought dueling over.
Scotch-Irish?
Yeah, Scotch-Irish, the French as well. And so, you know, the formality of dueling was actually, you know, more of a European conceit than anything else. So in a sense, you see these gentlemen, one reason they do it on the Kentucky frontier in the early 1800s, because it's a way of sort of showing them, you know, showing everyone that, oh, we're the high class people here because of the way we kill each other, you know. But it was essentially a European phenomenon that came over. In that way, and then it eventually, you know, spread. And the duel book I'm working on now, one thing I talk about in that is how Kentuckians then took their dueling culture to Missouri. So a lot of the Missourians who dueled before the Civil War all had Kentucky connections or were from Kentucky, you know, like Crittendens and Gratzes. I mean, it's crazy. So you can sort of see them taking that culture with them. Just as it spread from Europe to the States, you know, Kentuckians then took it elsewhere. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Talk about the
Yeah. Right. The question was, were dueling pistols used, were they smoothbore or rifled? And so if a pistol's rifled, it's got grooves in it that makes the bullet fly straighter. These were typically smoothbore because the idea of dueling was sort of fairness. It was also seen as being more traditional as well. Like Henry Clay's dueling pistols were flintlocks. So even when percussion caps were invented in sort of modern pistols for the mid-19th century were invented, they still used flintlock pistols a lot. So it's that sort of tradition was part of it. Also, the men didn't always want to kill each other. You know, it was sort of duels, the whole idea was to keep them fair. If your opponent was injured, you wouldn't fight. If he was wounded, you wouldn't fight because that wouldn't be fair. So I mentioned the Deshaies-Kimbrough duel. He hit the guy with the chair. They got in a fist fight. That caused the duel where the former Confederate shot the former Union guy through the hips. That duel was actually delayed because in the fist fight, the former Confederate had hurt his hand. And so they were afraid he couldn't pull the trigger well enough. So they actually delayed that fight by a couple of weeks. So, but the question is, they tended to use sort of more traditional weapons as dueling. So again, I think it was seen as being more more sort of upper crust and more traditional in that way. So, yes, sir.
How active was the Clarksville dueling ground? Is it?
Right.
I know of one, but.
Right. The question was, how active was the dueling ground down in southern Kentucky, where the racetrack is, that one?
Well, Clarksville, no, Silver Creek.
Indiana.
In Indiana?
In Indiana.
Huh.
Yeah.
I'm not as aware of that one. That's one. My research is mainly focused on Kentucky and a little bit in Tennessee. And in Kentucky, where the Kentucky Horse Park is now, a corner of that property was actually a prime dueling ground. And two of the duels I mentioned were actually fought there. And the reason it was is they would typically find places that were on the border, and that was on the Fayette County, Scott County line. And so it would be, again, difficult to determine who had jurisdiction to prosecute the duelists. That's why they'd fight there typically. And down in Tennessee, where the Dueling Ground racetrack is now, that's where I think Andrew Jackson fought one there. But again, that was sort of near the Kentucky-Tennessee line. So it's hard to prosecute people, and that's why they chose those sorts of locations. But people came to Kentucky to duel early in the Civil War. There were two Indiana legislators who came down here to fight using Bowie knives, but their friends talked them out of it before the fight actually happened. And one was a Southern sympathizer, the other was a Unionist. And so that duel did not happen. But again, a lot of times people saw Kentucky as a safe place to come and kill your opponent. Hooray! Hey. Any other questions at all? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I mean, I think the question was, were there other cultural differences where it was better to be seen as not dueling and being more mature about it? And, you know, the Northeast, dueling was not there. There was still the code of honor. It was more, it wasn't a completely Southern phenomenon, but by the time, you know, it tended to be much more of a Southern thing. So the Northeast tended to avoid dueling. And, you know, a lot of people are, there's some historians who've argued that the sort of the slavery and the slave culture sort of contributed to violence and dueling because overseers and slave owners frequently went around armed because they feared slave insurrection. So because of that, they had pistols on them. They're used to using violence to deal with their enslaved people. So then that was easily transferred as ways they dealt with their peers too. So that's sort of that's one reason it was also another sort of distinctly Southern phenomenon. Well, thank you all for having me here. Really appreciate it. I will. I definitely will.